This is the Skilding Podcast. In this episode of the podcast, we have Dr. Ian Robertson on, who is an author, and we're talking about one of his books. It's called How Confidence Works. And it's, I mean, this guy, he's a neuroscientist, so he knows what he's talking about, and he's studied this stuff for decades. And so one of the things I thought was interesting was how to understand the difference between self-esteem, confidence, how to spot when you're being overconfident. It's just a fascinating episode. I hope you enjoy it. So here is Dr. Ian Robertson, and the book is called How Confidence Works. So hello, welcome along to the podcast on this episode. I am genuinely honored to be joined by Ian Robertson, author of several books. And the one book we're going to be talking about today is How Confidence Works. So Ian, hello, welcome.
Hi, Kevin. Nice to meet you.
Tell us, Joe, actually, I had a strange question to begin with about this book. Why is it called How Confidence Works and not called How to Be Confident? Is there any particular reason, or is it just because it's about what confidence is? And because there is stuff in it about how to be confident as well.
There is, and because I'm a scientist first and a clinician second, and so I can't promise that it will work what I say in the book, but what I can do is be very accurate and honest about the scientific underpinnings of confidence. And so I guess in all of my books, what I like people to do is to understanding better how their own minds and brains work, how they can then put that into action. And, you know, as you say, I do give some, if you like, practical advice, but I don't do it in the manner of a self-help book. So how to be confident is too brash for a scientist.
Fair enough. Yeah, I think you've done a good job at it, though, because by explaining how it works, it's almost like the tools are laid out for you, like that if you can understand your beliefs and you can understand, you know, what sabotages your confidence and what the triggers are for knocking down your confidence and that kind of thing. I think once you understand those things, you can kind of apply it to your own life. And you're right as well that if you were to tell people this is how to be confident, it makes out like it's a one size fits all, like it's like, you know, 7 minute abs kind of thing. It's just ridiculous. So like it was the first thing that struck me about it was it's how confidence works, whereas you would expect a book about confidence to be called something like How to Be Confident. So
if you're a working class woman in a highly inequitable society and a misogynistic society, I cannot guarantee that women can become more confident, you know, because of the various undermining pressures that exist. So that's another reason why, you know, I don't want to oversell.
I think it's a great name. I think it's a great book. I should have started actually by asking you to tell everybody who you are and what you do. And sure. So
I'm Ian Robertson. I'm Emeritus Professor of Psychology in Trinity College Dublin. I was the founding director of the Institute of Neuroscience there, and I was originally trained as a clinical psychologist. Came, you know, relatively late in life to be cognitive neuroscience researcher. So now I try and combine my two lives, my clinical and my scientific lives, to really help bring science to for people to use and understand their own minds and brains better.
What's your motivation for doing this work? Like, what's your, is it possible to put your finger on what it is that interests you about the brain or about neuroscience in general?
Well, it's a great question. Human consciousness is the last completely inexplicable frontier. It's a complete pain in the ass for physicists to try and understand human consciousness. None of the theories of the, you know, the unifying potential, unifying theories of the universe can encompass that. So this is the fact that you have aware human, self-aware human beings able to, if you like, leapfrog the biology of their genetic evolutionary status to build civilizations and to change themselves, becoming kind of self-programming computers in a way, you know, to use that analogy. So it's that amazing power of human beings to create. Well, I guess this brings me to the confidence book. I mean, the critical thing about human beings compared to other species is they imagine things that don't exist at the moment. They project them into the future and then they work towards creating them. No other species does that. And to do that requires not just imagination, but it requires that an act of faith, and that act of faith is confidence that I can do that. So confidence is the fuel that gets you over that that bridge to an imagined future. And that, you know, that's, I mean, what human beings have achieved is just, as a species, is just incredible.
Hmm.
to understanding the universe, the science, that, you know, knowing how 14 billion years old, that's the scientific understanding, the collective end, the collective activity to build knowledge and to improve the, hugely improve the lot of fellow human beings. And you can't understand that without understanding human mind and brain.
You and I listen to podcasts for many reasons. And listening to a podcast like this probably means that you're looking to get insights about human psychology, motivation, persuasion, things like that. Well, if you're here to learn, listening is not enough. In fact, that'll get you one third of the way there. You will understand this topic. That's the first part. But secondly, you need to remember the most actionable content when you need it. It's what we call remembering it at the moment of truth. And thirdly, you'll need to find opportunities to deliberately practice this content. This episode has a suite of learning tools that you can use to help you do this. Just go to skillding.com and search for the title of this episode. Back to the show. Yeah, we are the universe observing itself.
Yeah,
I have a tangent already. I'm sometimes known for these tangents. I was in Amsterdam last weekend, and as you know, Amsterdam has loads of canals. And we were waiting to cross this bridge, and the bridge had gone up. And when the bridge went up, we were just kind of standing looking into the water, and there was two ducks. A duck had laid its eggs and made a nest, kind of like, you know, on a little bank bit there. And the other duck was going off and getting sticks and bringing them back. And I thought about this. I thought about what you said there about, we can imagine a future and then build. We can imagine something that doesn't exist, and then we can put the steps in place to go and make it real. How the hell do birds know how to build a nest? I can't build a nest. So there must be something that they have in their head to help them know where to put each twig or each little bit of grass or whatever it is.
Yeah, but they can imagine one thing about the future, that's a nest, and it's not, that's an evolved instinct that has been, they've been in natural selection, they've been selected for that capacity to knit together twigs and build a nest. And, you know, those members of the species that didn't acquire that ability, their offspring died out, and therefore genes weren't passed on. So ducks can imagine one thing.
We can imagine that, lots of things.
So nests are not new. Nests have always been there, but you know, going to the moon is new, or Teflon frying pans are new. You know, these didn't exist before. You know, imagine we could have frying pan that you didn't have to scrub, you know, so a duck couldn't do that. Yeah.
Good answer. Good answer. Yeah, I've wondered that for a long time. I should have thought of that myself. Yeah, it's natural selection that allowed them to do it. Okay, to the book. Tell us, why did you write this book? I imagine with the amount of things to do with the human brain that you could be talking about or writing about, what makes you decide, okay, this is the thing I'm going to write about?
I probably my wife, Fiona Doherty, is a clinical psychologist. She, ever since I met her, she was saying, look, if you can give a child confidence, basically you don't need to worry about anything else. Confidence is absolutely a critical psychological resource. And that belief that you can do things. And if you just listen to, all the news, just listen to all sports commentators, all political, economic, confidence is just in the air. You'll never hear a sports broadcast without someone talking about the confidence of the team. You never hear an economic discussion without saying, "Oh, consumer confidence." So it's in the air, and yet no one had written a book about it. So that's why I wrote it, and I do believe it's. I do believe it's particularly these days we have this kind of mental health crisis and high levels of anxiety, and confidence is the greatest antidote to anxiety, and anxiety is the greatest corrosive of confidence.
There's one of the things you say at the start of the book that optimism, hope, and self-esteem are concepts that are easily confused with confidence.
Yeah,
I would have confused those. So can you unconfuse them for us?
So optimism is the sunny belief that things will turn out. Hope is quite similar to optimism, but there's a bit more energy behind it, but it's not specific. I really hope this is going to happen, but it's not. It's a kind of motivational impulse, but it's non-specific. Self-esteem is a kind of rating of yourself, an evaluation of yourself that actually can sometimes have the opposite effect of confidence, because people spend huge amounts of time trying to protect it. The secret source of confidence is it's linked to action. And in the brain, it's linked to the action systems of the brain. So it makes you do stuff. And so confidence is the belief that you can do a particular thing, and that if you do it, the outcome will follow. So that's a secret sauce. It makes you do stuff.
And I suppose with confidence as well, I think you'd say it later on in the book as well, that there's reality built into it as well. Like, it's not just like you're saying about the optimism, it's just everything is going to work out great. Whereas,
yeah, people talk these days, and I don't really know about it. I haven't read anything about things like manifesting and this idea that you can, by simply imagining some precious desired future goal, you can will it into place. I mean, that's that's not true. But there's, on its own, imagining something, a really precious future goal for yourself, can energize you. But without intermediate steps where you set specific goals for yourself, and that are hard enough that they stretch you, but not too hard. They're in a kind of sweet spot of goals. You have to, when there is that uncertainty, when they stretch you, you need confidence to say, I can do this, even though it's not 100% certain. That's how confidence works. It bridges uncertainty, because the future is always uncertain. Marissa Mayer, the first woman CEO of a major tech company, she said, she'd said this about success, but it's also true about confidence, that success is about doing things before you feel quite ready. And confidence is also doing things when you're not 100%, your ducks are not all in a row necessarily. There is that sense of, yeah, I think I can do this, I can do this, but there always has to be that kind of uncertainty if you really are stretching yourself and going to get the benefit of success, breeding success.
I remember when I was a lot younger, I think I might have heard it when I was in school, maybe, that somebody, I couldn't even tell you who it was, whether it was a teacher or who, but they said, you should have a go-first principle, that if somebody is asked, you know, somebody needs a volunteer for something in school, your hand should just shoot up and go, I'll do it. And I've always felt that, whether rightly or wrongly, that always gave me confidence that, well, everyone else is just as afraid to do the thing. I'm going to try and do the thing, whatever the thing is. So that's something that's always served me well, and I think has helped me be more confident in my, like you said, finding those stretch goals and you know, it's like a bumper sticker or something, but nothing good ever happens in your comfort zone. Like, I think that's the gist.
No, that's dead right. And you know, the great Afghanistani Persian poet Rumi said, you know, the path only appears with the first step. If you don't take that first step, there's all sorts of paths that don't appear to you.
Yeah.
And you're right. If you've been in the habit of putting up your hand, of doing the thing in spite of a bit of doubt and uncertainty and anxiety that goes with that, the more you do that, the easier it becomes. And then the benefits of that multiply over a lifetime. Yeah. So it works like compound interest. You know, it's an exponential quality to it. There's mathematical evidence for this, of this kind of exponential compound interest quality of confidence.
There was times in my life as well where my hand had gone up before. I was like, oh, shit.
I know.
I volunteered for something. I've barely listened what I volunteered for. Yeah. I just had such a habit of, like, just sticking my hand up.
Yeah.
Another thing you say in the book then is that confidence is made of two parts. What are the two parts?
Yeah, so that's I can do this. And if I do this, then the good outcome that I'm doing it for will happen. So that gives you four states of the mind. Well, the hardest state to beat is can't do, won't happen, and that creates a state of apathy in the brain and the mind, where it actually lowers mood, lowers motivation, lowers initiative, makes it very hard. You know, chronic real trauma and really adverse circumstances, you know, poverty can create states of mind where it's, you know, it's very hard. You feel apathetic, and you feel there's no point, because not only can't you do it, but even if you did do it, it couldn't happen. But that then gives you the second state of mind, which is can do, won't happen, and that's the sense of, look, I could get a college degree. But from where I come from, it's not going to make any difference to my job prospects. And that tends to lead to a sense of anger and frustration. And there's a lot of that in politics these days. And then there's the opposite one, which is can't do, could happen. So, you know, I just can't study. I don't think I can get that degree. I know if I could, I'd get a better job, but I just can't do it. And that tends to lead to anxiety and depression. And both the anger and the anxiety activate chemical messengers in the brain that, when they're in too high a level, they disrupt your thinking and make it hard to think straight and solve your problems. And they mix up with each other, so that when you're angry, you're anxious, and when you're anxious, you're angry. And then there's the full whammy, you know, can do, could happen. And that that's confidence. And that acts as a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, and has a number of effects on your mind and brain. It's a natural antidepressant because of its effects on the brain's dopamine system. It's a natural anti-anxiety drug because of these effects of anticipating successful outcome. It's a natural motivator. It makes you more likely to actually do the thing, and it makes you slightly smarter. because of the effects of the dopamine in the frontal lobes of the brain. So it's that's why confident sports people and confident teams do better, is because their brains are actually, they function better biologically and psychologically as a result of the confidence.
I'm going to ask you a question, but I think by asking this question, I'm basically asking you to summarize the entire book, but I'll do it anyway. How do you overcome the first three then, if you need to get to that fourth one?
You mean the can-do, can-happen?
Yeah. Like say I am somebody who is can't do, won't happen.
Right.
Is there a way to get to can do?
Yeah, there is. And so there's a whole lot of steps that, you know, I didn't explicitly outline in the book, but in the talks I've been given since, I've started to distill the kind of a number of A's, and you know, I won't go through them all, but one of them is action. And so that, you know, no matter how stuck you feel, how hopeless you feel, and of course, anxiety makes you avoid. Anxiety does the opposite of confidence. It tends to stop you taking action. I've got a headache, I'm not going to meet you tonight. Or, oh, no point, I'm not going to go to that interview. What's the point in studying? I can't do this. So anxiety makes people avoid, pull back, which is the opposite of what confidence does. It makes you take action. So it follows from that, one of the critical things in building is to just take that tiny bit of action that stretches you just a little bit. And it can be a mini step. And it's something that you set yourself. It's not something that it can be determined by someone else, and certainly it's not something you can determine in comparison or competition with other people. So your goal is your goal, and that if you know you've maybe been stuck at home, socially anxious, not wanting to mix with anyone, your goal is not to become some mega popular socialite. Your goal is, I'm going to go and meet that friend for a cup of coffee for 20 minutes. That's going to be my goal. And if I do that, that's my first set of ideas. And that's why the goals are so important. You can't set a goal that's so hard that you're likely to fail, and then that has the opposite effect. You can't set a goal that's just so easy that it doesn't give you that buzz of achieving it. So setting goals for action is probably the single most important way of busting out of that bubble of apathy and lack of confidence.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in setting goals. I'm also just as big a believer in having systems to achieve those goals. And one of the things, I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I put on weight over the lockdowns and all that, you know, just by being sedentary, really. And a friend of mine challenged me to lose 2 stone by last Christmas, just gone. So I had exactly 6 months. It was June 25th till December 25th. I had to lose 2 stone. And fear was a big driver of, not winning the bet. But I had a goal, a very simple goal to, you know, get the scales down by 2 stone. And one of the things that I disregarded almost immediately was the need for motivation, because motivation will let you down again and again. Mm. And what I needed more than anything was discipline. I would not negotiate with my mind. So like you're saying about taking that first step, I'd remove frictions. Like, so where I am now, I literally have my weights behind me here. This is where I work out. There's very little friction between spinning around in the chair and just picking up the weights.
Yeah.
But I would make sure that I'd have shorts there. I'd have bottled water and everything I needed. I'd remove that friction. So I would have systems in place help me achieve, to help me take that first step.
No, that's right. Motivation is a set of habits, not some mysterious internal state. And these habits are, as you say, minimizing the obstacles and reducing the friction. Absolutely.
So I want to kind of jump around the book a bit there, but I want to go back then, say, to we've probably covered how confidence works, chapter 2, because it's action it's a little step and little steps in building momentum. So chapter three, then, how confidence declines. Can you talk a little bit about how that can happen? Like, I could. So what happens to me sometimes is that I'm gung ho working out every day, and then all of a sudden it just kind of fades, and that bad habit starts slipping in again. I have to almost ramp up again, like to go and start again. You know, is that to do with confidence, or is that just, you know, habits not being stuck properly or something?
So once we get into, you know, confidence is about is more about believing that you can do something more than habits have their own momentum to them, and habits can fade, and sometimes you need to inject you need to inject them with a bit of conscious intention again. So they reckon that to establish a habit, even a simple habit like eating a piece of fruit after your dinner, to establish that habit so that it becomes something that doesn't require effort, that doesn't require conscious control, you have to do that about 60 or 70 times deliberately before it then becomes something you can do effortlessly, if you like, without having to think about it. And so habits can fade over time. So you have to then refresh habits by going back to that conscious control. Okay, I'm slipping here. And then you set a goal for yourself. Right, my goal is I'm going to reestablish this habit so it's no longer something that I have to think about. Okay, that means you might not have to do it 60 or 70 times consciously, but you might have to do it a dozen times, saying, right, I'm not negotiating, I'm doing this. So there your goal is an internal one of building a habit. Okay, so goals can be both internal and external, and you need confidence for both. And sometimes the internal goals can be harder to maintain and be aware of and to make because they are inside your own mind. So you can have an internal goal to do slow, deep breathing every time you notice that you're feeling pressured or anxious, you know. But you have, it's so hard to monitor yourself because the very nature of anxiety is your mind tends to skip around. So, but if you can really get a clear internal goal, you can say, right, my goal is I'm going to learn to practice slow breathing in order to control my anxiety. So that's the internal goal setting, which is tough, but very effective.
What's failing confidently? What's that chapter about?
Failure is, success is a poor teacher.
Yeah, it is.
You know, you see this with some very successful people who have an awful inclination to attribute that success to some heroic and wonderful and magical qualities in themselves, and to completely miss the fact that probably 90% of their success is good fortune, pure chance, maybe a bit of persistence through failure, having people who help them, being at the right place in the right time. You know, for every successful business person, there's 1,000 much smarter, much harder working, much more innovative business people that failed. It just their timing wasn't right, the market, the circumstances. So that's why success is such a poor teacher. In fact, success can be a real bad teacher because it tends to create this delusion of that inflates the ego and makes people narcissistically believe that they're godlike and they're, you know, magical abilities to get where they were. Whereas failure actually is much more specific because you can learn from failure. What was it about my behavior or the circumstances or my learning or the people I was with? What aspects of that led to that failure? And that is a hugely rich set of potential teaching signals that you can learn for to make it more likely you're successful in the future. However, psychologically, human beings find it very hard to address failure, to square up to failure. There's a tendency to mentally run away from it, to avoid it, because it's threatening to the ego embarrassing and makes you feel anxious and bad and low. But if you can square up to it, you can really learn. And one great obstacle to that is to learning from failure is having what Carol Dweck, the great psychologist, calls a fixed mindset. If you have a theory of yourself that who you are and what you are is determined genetically or fixed, then if you have a failure experience, that's not something you're not going to see that as something you can learn from. Rather, that's a threat to your concept of yourself. Maybe I'm not bright, or maybe I'm not popular, or maybe I'm not attractive. And that the brain responds completely differently to failure signals in people with that kind of fixed mindset compared to people with a more accurate, change mindset, which says, yeah, most of what I do is a result of a whole set of circumstances, and it's easier for that brain to learn to learn from the failure so as to improve in the future.
I used to have a chutney company a long time ago. Started as a joke, kind of got fairly serious. And just to give a little bit of background, so Supervalue, which I'm sure you're familiar with, there's a lot of listeners all around the world, but Supervalue is like kind of the main chain of supermarkets here in Ireland. And to get into Supervalues, you have to get into what they call central listing, right? So it's in the central distribution place and it kind of goes with all Supervalues. You have to be in about 5% of the Supervalues independently before they'll even listen to you. So I had to figure all this out. And I had no sales experience. I had no idea about talking to grown-ups, none of that. And I remember going into a Supervalue with the jars of chutney that we were selling and panicking. God, I don't know. I found the manager and I remember walking towards him and thinking, I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no clue. And I just kind of babbled a load of stuff at him, just kind of put three jars like into his arms, and he's standing going, I don't understand what this is. I don't understand what's happening. And I remember getting back into the car and feeling like shame and embarrassment and just like that horrible feeling of like, what was that? But there was some part of me in my head that said, well, that didn't go well. Let's do it again. And I remember I would do it again and again and again. And rather than doing it again blindly, every time I did it, I'd sit back into the car with a notebook and pen and write down everything I could think of to do with that interaction. Like, say, for example, there was things I used to do, like, I think about it now, it's laughable, but I remember I'd come up behind the manager and scare the shit out of him, and he'd be like, but what? And like, so, and then I'd be all apologetic and I'd be, I'm so sorry, and I know you're busy, and that's all wrong with sales. I'm the solution to your problem is what I basically got into that mindset of. And it became like a performance. Like, it's almost like a Venn diagram between a performance of a salesperson and who I really am. Like, and in the middle of those two was that sweet spot of like being able to just kind of present myself well and, you know, be nice and be genuine and whatever. But I always remember thinking that I don't know why I had that mindset of being able to separate myself emotionally from the situation. Like, it didn't damage my ego. In the long term, it just became like, okay, well, this is a performance. I think I can do this better if I just do it again. And then with my own business now, like, it's almost like you become a masochist. Like, I like when people say no to me because I'll get you eventually. That's what I always think. I'll get you eventually. Like, I'll figure something out to get you to understand what it is I'm trying to sell.
Well, that's a really interesting point, Kevin. I remember, I've got just this concept of performance. I've got a very low threshold for boredom. And I remember even I was in Australia giving a talk, this is 30, 40 years ago, and someone was offering to fly me up to Darwin to give the same talk up there. I'd given the talk two or three times, and I just couldn't bear to give the same talk again. And so I regret it ever since, because I'd love to have gone to Darwin, Australia. However, during lockdown, I was doing, RTE asked me to do workshops with all the staff twice, from the top to the bottom, in groups of maybe 20 to 30. So I had to do the same workshop maybe 10, 12 times. And, you know, in the past, I just could not have done that. And then, but it was after the second or third, I suddenly realized this is a performance.
Yeah.
I am disseminating information, but I'm also having an effect on other people at a difficult time in their lives.
Yeah.
Just like I'm saying, well, look, these actors in the West End or in the Gate Theatre who perform sometimes twice a day, the same play, the same lines, they're interested in improving their, how they say them the next night. They're not going to be bored with the lines. It's the performance is their focus. And that really just saw me through. And I really, to the, you know, even the 12th one, I was actually looking forward to it and enjoying it, because I was saying, just even the pause you make, it's, because, you know, it's what people remember. Yeah. It's how it's getting the point across. And I think that's true, because one of the other A's of the confidence, if you like, tips, is the actor mindset. That notion of the cliche, fake it till you make it.
Mm.
Because if there's self-doubt, and there always has to be self-doubt if you're bridging into uncertainty in the future, then there's always going to be that nagging feeling that you're an imposter, or you're just faking this. That's why you need the actor mindset. You need to be the performer, just exactly as you described it. And you know, it was a very, very nice description of, you know, of also using failure as a teacher.
Yeah.
Great.
I'll tell you something else as well. I used to give a lot of seminars around the country teaching study skills to students. I gave the same seminar hundreds of times, if not thousands of times. And like that, I might do it like four times in a week, and it could be like a 5-hour session. So like by the fourth one, I'm just losing my mind. And sometimes I remember fairly early on, again, I remember realizing I am bored, and my mind is wandering off as I'm talking. Like words are coming out of my mouth. I'm thinking about dinner or something, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember having this thought going, do you know what? That's ego. If I'm bored, it's ego. I'm here to be of service to these kids.
Exactly.
They have never heard this before. And I owe them my full attention. And once I had that, and it's the same thing with you at RTE, that once you realize that you're there to be of service, you're not there to be entertained, you're there to do the job.
And
I think that really helped me overcome that that kind of hurdle, you know, of tuning out.
And that's right. And that's where this focus on, you know, forgetting your ego, forgetting you, and then focusing on this future goal, on the outcome, you know, that has all sorts of positive effects, and you know, the self-doubt and the anxiety and the kind of fear that what do people think of me. If you're focused on the goal, you don't there's less concern about these things.
I want to be cognizant of your time here. Tell me a little bit about overconfidence. There's a chapter on overconfidence, people, I suppose, it can be an overcorrection then as well.
Look, any powerful source of energy or force or equipment or can be used, anything that can work well is potentially can do bad things as well. And that's particularly true of confidence, because it is a two-edged sword. And actually being slightly overconfident is an asset that men benefit from more than women on average, That's why they're, you know, men will overestimate their scores in a general knowledge test, and women will tend to underestimate their scores or be more accurate. But that kind of slight unrealism about your chances in the future of your abilities actually is a great motivator. It takes you forward in the way we described earlier. However, and because it works so well, because confidence is a huge salesman, let me say. Confidence is an incredible salesman. A confident person will buy, and it's usually him rather than she, but it also works for women, will buy him status. And status then, you get all sorts of other advantages by having high status. And therefore you get more likelihood of success. And so it multiplies itself. And so that's why, this confident, overconfident people can shoot up to the top of hierarchies. And, sometimes it's really undesirable personalities that do that, because they're not constrained by ethical or moral or human kindness. There's a ruthlessness gets them up there, and of course we can think of examples of that. I don't need to give you. And then of course what that overconfidence does, it creates in the brain and mind, it creates narcissism, because you of the tendency then to assume that all your success is because not of primitive dominance hierarchies and the fact that success breeds success, or the escalator exponential effect of confidence, or chance, or other people, or whatever it is, at the right time in the right place, you think it's you. And that's why very rich people usually end up trying to find the secret of eternal life, or starting to make themselves appear godlike. They want to feel immortal, because they feel so special the world cannot do without them. And then when that happens, okay, so what happens in the mind and brain? You lose self-awareness, you lose empathy, you start treating other people as objects, your judgment becomes severely impaired, particularly your ability to perceive risk and danger, you identify your own personal, what's good for you is good for the nation and vice versa, or the company. And that's why, Vladimir Putin would just be a horrible example of that these days, where you have millions of, hundreds of thousands of people dying because of one man's ego and narcissism, which he cloaks in national, nationalism and all this kind of thing. So, overconfidence brings down, it brings down companies often. And the crash of 2007-08 was overconfidence in the markets. And when you're overconfident, your brain is actually less able to remember past negative events. It selectively brings up from your memory past success events. And your attention is also biased towards evidence of good things happening. So I remember the Irish, Prime Minister Bertie Ahern, just a couple of years before the boom, and his government's policies had just been totally reckless in spending. And he said, "Oh, the boom is getting boomier." And people were warning. He said, "Oh, why don't they go and commit suicide?" The warning of risk. So that was his brain and his mind were just totally derailed into this world where there's only success, there's never failure, only good times, not risks or downtimes. And that's true, that can happen to all of us. And it's what happens in compulsive gambling, which is a dreadful, dreadful problem, as bad as heroin or alcohol addiction for people that succumb to it. Anyway, that's a whole other story.
What's a final question then on this, and I'll let you go then. How would somebody know if they are being overconfident? Is it like that Bertie Ahern thing of like, I can only see upside, I can't see any downside to this? Like,
it's a great question, because one of the features of overconfidence is it dulls your self-awareness. Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. Self-awareness is probably the most important thing. Like for
yeah, and it's very, very difficult to, when someone becomes intoxicated, because overconfidence tends to give you power and wealth. And someone who has a lot of power, it's very difficult for them not to feel that they're entitled to that power and that they're safe repositories of that power. And, you know, everything they do appears to them justified. And whereas powerless people have to, much more of their brain activity and their mental activity is devoted to trying to read the intentions of people who have power over them. And so they have to be much more aware of themselves and what their behavior is, because if they behave the wrong way, then the person in the power will punish them. So powerlessness builds sometimes painful self-awareness, whereas power does the very opposite. And that's why the only two constraints on overconfidence and power are one's internal, one's external. And the external one is governance. And in politics, it's an independent, a free press, which is critical, independent judiciary, elections. All of these things constrain what otherwise leads to Erdogan's or Trump's or Putin's. Yeah. And the other are internal constraints, which are moral and ethical constraints that are, if you like, inbuilt in the person's mind who holds power. And that's why anyone who's, people who have a strong ethical or moral set of internal constraints are more likely to be able to be self-critical and maybe less likely to succumb to dangerous overconfidence.
This is a fascinating topic. I love it. Dr. Ian Robertson, where is the best place for people to find out more about what you do and where your books are and stuff?
Well, they can look at my website, which is ianrobertson.org. I've got on, you can look for me on YouTube. There's quite a number of talks and lectures on there. And the book How Confidence Works, published by Penguin.
Excellent. What's your next book going to be?
It's probably going to be on virtue.
Oh, nice. Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, thanks very much for being on the podcast. Very much appreciate it.
Thanks, Kevin. Great talking to you.
Hey, before you go, just a quick message about Skilding and what we're all about. We believe that true learning happens when you understand, remember, and deliberately practice your newly acquired knowledge. This podcast just covered the first part. You now understand the key takeaways from this book. To help you remember them, we will send you three interactive summaries that accompany this episode to empower you to remember the key takeaways at that moment of truth. To really embed the knowledge from this episode, you can use the dedicated and completely private digital portfolio to set a time and a date to go out into the big bad world and deliberately practice the key takeaways covered in this episode. For all this and for all of our podcast episodes, head over to skillding.com, that's skillding.com, and search for the title of this episode. Until next time.